UK government might have shut down?
Let's end this shutdown right now. Let's put people back to work.
Listen, there's never been a president in our history that did not negotiate over the debt limit. Never. Not once.
But you can count on us. Welcome to News One Now with Roland Martin.
Good morning, I'm Roland Martin, broadcasting live from Atlanta at the Hope Global Forum's annual meeting. Next on News One Now, a federal judge rules that the Texas voter ID law passed in 2011 intentionally discriminates against minorities, despite claims it was enacted to fight voter fraud. Christian Clark, the president and executive director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights on the Law, will join us to discuss. Also, folks, in just a few hours, some of the biggest influencers will gather here in Atlanta, all with the goal of revamping the global economy, specifically as it relates to how it impacts people of color and poor folks. I'll talk to John Hope Bryant, the man behind this week's Hope Global Forum's annual meeting. Also, a big overhaul in leadership at Morehouse College. Former President John Wilson is out. Interim President William Taggart is in. We'll give you the latest on the drama at Morehouse. Plus, the man who inspired the movie The Pursuit of Happiness is here to discuss the Hope Global Forum. We'll talk with Chris Gardner about his own journey from struggle to success and uplifting the invisible class. Also, last night here, I moderated a conversation between Ambassador Andrew Young and John Rogers Jr. of Ariel Capital Management, talking about how do we focus on the invisible class in America. It's a conversation you don't want to miss. It's time to bring the funk on News One Now on TV One. Let's go. A federal judge has ruled that the controversial Texas voter ID law intentionally discriminates against minority voters. The ruling is a victory for civil rights advocates who've been fighting the law since it was passed by the Texas legislature in 2011. U.S. District Judge Nelva Gonzalez-Ramos wrote in her decision that the plaintiff's evidence established that discrimination was, quote, at least one of the substantial or motivating factors behind passage of the bill. She also pointed out that, quote, evidence of a pattern unexplainable on grounds other than race, such as proposed changes to the law that was rejected by the Texas legislature that would have eased the negative effect on minority voters. One of the plaintiffs in the case, the Texas NAACP, said, quote, sadly, this is one more instance of the state that many of us love so deeply being found to have engaged in intentional discrimination against citizens of color. At some point, this discrimination based on the color of Texas citizens must stop. Also, folks, this is the fifth time a court has ruled that the Texas voter ID law is intentionally discriminatory. Now, in February, the Trump Department of Justice announced it was withdrawing from the legal battle waged by the Obama administration against the Texas law. In fact, they even said that they were not going to focus on the discriminatory impact of the law. Joining us by phone from D.C. is Christian Clark, President and Executive Director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. Christian, here's what's interesting here. This is a clear slapdown of the Trump administration. Here we have Attorney General Jeff Sessions, so-called lauded during his confirmation hearings by being an advocate for civil rights, but he clearly sided on the side of Texas in this case, but this federal judge makes it clear that his DOJ is wrong, Trump is wrong, Texas is wrong.
Right. This Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, is off to a bad start. This was one of the earliest things that he did during his tenure. He made the 11th hour decision to abandon the intent claim, the argument that this law was adopted with a discriminatory purpose. It was truly remarkable. We and some of the other groups that have been fighting this law literally were boarding planes, bags in hand, heading down to Texas for this critical argument when we received a call from the Justice Department indicating that they would no longer be standing shoulder to shoulder with us, making the argument that the law was adopted with a discriminatory purpose. So yesterday's ruling is a vindication of the position that we've long been taking, which is that this law is infected with discriminatory purpose at every stage and should be fully rendered null and void.
Well, and also I believe that anybody who is an advocate of civil rights, who is against voter suppression, has to take the position that this Trump administration doesn't give a damn about minority voters, doesn't care about discriminatory impact. They are going to make political decisions siding with Republicans who have been pushing voter suppression consistently since, first of all, for the longest, but definitely since 2010 after the election of President Barack Obama in 2008.
That's right. At every turn, we're seeing evidence that this Justice Department and Attorney General Sessions in particular stands fully opposed to civil rights. We knew that Sessions brings with him a record of great hostility on civil rights. We can't forget his actions last week attempting to obstruct a carefully negotiated police department consent decree, one that was backed by the mayor and by police officials and by the community. The one person standing as an obstacle to reform was Mr. Sessions. Here he attempted to do the same. He attempted to disrupt this litigation, but the judge saw the writing on the wall and issued a short 10-page ruling that makes clear that Texas knew that this law would have a discriminatory effect on African-American and Latino voters, and despite that, statistical data adopted the law anyway. This is also not the first time that Texas has been shot down for taking action that's intentionally discriminatory. A court last month in a redistricting case found that officials acted with discriminatory purpose. All of this is such a reminder about why we need the important provisions that have been in place under the Voting Rights Act prior to a 2013 Supreme Court ruling. Since that time, groups like the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law have been fighting case after case across the country against voter suppression efforts and discriminatory measures like the one in place in Texas.
Christian, hold tight 1 second. Here in Atlanta, folks, is our panel. Derek Bozeman, WAOK radio weekday host. Lynn May, journalist and communications consultant. And Darrell Wilson, the CEO of Wilson Mediation. Again, when you look at this particular case, when you look at North Carolina, when you look at Alabama, we can go down the line where Republicans are in control of the legislature and the governor's mansion, there's a consistent effort to suppress the vote. They know the numbers are changing. They are angry with the massive black turnout. They elected President Barack Obama in 2008 and 2012. And I don't care what anyone says, they're going to continue to try to deny minorities the right to vote. They are not about defending civil rights.
Absolutely not. This shouldn't be a surprise to us. The question is, if you add gerrymandering to that, we're on the road to disenfranchisement.
I think it's very clear that those who love freedom, those who love justice, those who think that civil rights are important, we've just got to gear up to fight. The other side has drawn a line in the sand and made it very, very clear that when it comes to voter suppression, when it comes to all kind of bills, here in Georgia, we had just passed in this legislative session a very clear gerrymandering bill where an incumbent, two incumbents, whose districts had gotten down to 51% Republican performing, they said, oh no, we can't have that. We're going to take some of the white people out of the district that's in a black district, take some of the black people out of that district, put them in a black district with black constituencies, because we need some of the white people to be in the district where we're trying to gerrymander to where a white representative lives and happen to serve. And so I think it's very clear. This is going to be a fight, and we might as well just say what it is and get ready for it.
I think that part of what we need to do is try to expose kind of the central truth about this. It is politics, and gerrymandering goes on both sides. You know, if you're a Republican state, it's going to be leaning Republican. If you're a Democrat, it's going to lean Democrat. I think what they're trying to do in Texas is try to find the right thing. You know, how do we get voter ID to everyone? That's something that Texas wants to do. But they need to do it cheaply so that everyone can be afford to do it.
But actually, that's not what they're trying to do. I mean, what they're trying to do is, again, this Texas voter ID will impact some 6 100,000 minorities. And so what they desperately want to do is they don't want Texas flipping. You look at what happened in this past election, significant wins by Democrats in three of the largest counties in Texas, Dallas County, Harris County, where Houston is, and Bexar County, where San Antonio is. Then you throw in Travis County, we'll have Austin. And so again, you see the numbers. Also, Texas is getting 500,000 new citizens every single month. The reason they got five new congressional seats was because of the influx of Latinos in that state. They actually turned four of those seats into Republican seats, one into a Democratic seat. That was also thrown out as well. And so what you're dealing with is, as Lynn said, a combination between voter ID and racial gerrymandering. You don't see it to this extent on the Democratic side as you do on the Republican side.
No, absolutely not. Not only that, they do it under the guise of voter fraud. And there's so little voter fraud in this country.
In fact, the Texas folks, am I correct, Christian, when they went to court, they only presented 12 cases of alleged voter fraud right. in a decade. Mm-hmm.
That's right. And the judge pointed to that and claimed and used that to show that this so-called vote fraud justification that they were using to support the law was a lie, was thin, didn't stand up. Voter suppression and voting discrimination, that's exactly right, Roland. This is not a matter of politics. This is about locking African Americans and Latinos out of the process. And there were more than 600,000 people in Texas who were registered voters who were disenfranchised when this law was put on the books. Whether we're talking about photo ID laws, purging of the voter rolls, moving polling sites to locations deemed hostile by the minority community, sadly, these are so many things that we're seeing in 2017 across our country.
Well, clearly, now that we have nine folks, first of all, clearly Texas, they're going to appeal this decision. It will go through the courts. No doubt it will likely go to the Supreme Court. We now have nine justices who sit on the Supreme Court with yesterday swearing in of Neil Gorsuch to the Supreme Court to replace the late Justice Antonin Scalia. This was Justice Anthony Kennedy yesterday at his official swearing in ceremony.
As Associate Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States.
As Associate Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States.
Under the Constitution and laws of the United States.
Under the Constitution and laws of the United States.
So help me God.
So help me God.
Now, Gorsuch swearing in followed 20 hours of bruising hearings in the Senate Judiciary Committee and a partisan fight on the Senate floor, which required Republicans to trigger the so-called nuclear option to confirm Gorsuch with just a simple majority and without any Democratic support, as opposed to the 60 votes traditionally needed to move forward a Supreme Court justice. Of course, now this move will also allow Trump to pick a future nominee that will tilt the court even further to the right. Trump relished his first victory as president.
I've always heard that the most important thing that a president of the United States does is appoint people, hopefully great people like this appointment, to the United States Supreme Court. And I can say this is a great honor. And I got it done in the first 100 days. That's even nice. You think that's easy?
Wow, just patting himself on the back. Hope he doesn't break his wrist. Christian, what do we already know about Neil Gorsuch? Potentially, how would he rule when it comes to, let's say, this Texas voter ID law?
You know, we review every Supreme Court nominee that's put forth. We look to see whether they are qualified and whether they have a record that demonstrates a profound commitment to the Constitution and to fair interpretation of civil rights laws. And we could not find that Judge Gorsuch met that standard. I presented testimony to the Senate Judiciary Committee during Judge Gorsuch's hearing, and one of the areas that I really highlighted were his cases in the criminal justice context. There he has a really narrow view about constitutional rights of criminal defendants, a real narrow view of the Fourth Amendment. He's somebody who brings a strong law enforcement perspective to bear on cases in that context. It was, you know, very interesting to hear him talk about his protocol being to look at individuals as individuals, that he doesn't bring with him a perspective. But in the law enforcement cases, somebody who sympathized with cops. He often granted immunity to cops in cases involving use of excessive force against victims. And he often talked about how cops are a community that often has to make quick judgments, and was very deferential to cops because of the sympathy he harbors for law enforcement in virtually all of the major criminal justice cases that came before him. So we're deeply concerned about his record and what that will mean for the major civil rights cases that will come before the Supreme Court in the road ahead.
All right, Kristen Clark, we certainly appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
About 90 seconds left with our panel here. Look, bottom line is this here. You now have four hard right Supreme Court justices.
Yes.
You have a moderate, if you will, in Justice Anthony Kennedy. And you have four liberal justices. But the reality is this here. What folks do when it comes to the ballot box will actually determine what takes place. You have the midterm elections coming up in 2018. You've got state races, gubernatorial races. So the real question is, will folks get out to vote to change the makeup of these legislatures? They're the ones that are passing these voter ID laws and voter suppression all across the country.
I think we clearly understand that elections have consequences. We're seeing that with the appointment of the Supreme Court justice and maybe one or two others. And I think on the local level, the same thing. And so if people are now not fired up to go vote, I don't know what else could happen in this country to make people understand you got to get out, you got to vote, you got to do your part.
I agree. And I think one of the things we saw, the 53% of white women who voted for Trump. And there's a problem with the electorate, you know, not understanding the issues, not understanding the consequences. And they'll know when they start to try to overturn Roe versus Wade, a lot of those women will say, oh, that's how this works.
Well, I think that elections do have consequences. And one of the things we've seen over the last few elections is that the African-American vote has traditionally gotten higher and higher voting Republican. And that's, I think, a sentiment that shows
where?
That
the
national
what
vote.
What are you talking about?
We got 3% increase over Romney and 3% more of that towards Trump.
3% increase where? 94% of black women voted against Donald Trump. And there was a 9-point gap between the black men and black women who voted for Mitt Romney, the same 9% when it came to Trump. That increase is not correct.
You're talking about African-American women. I'm talking about
No.
Black
I'm not talking about African-American women. There was a 9-point gap between black men and black women who voted for Mitt Romney in 2012. Uh-huh. It was the exact same 9-point gap between black men and black women in 2016 with Trump. 94% of black women voted for Hillary Clinton. That was a higher amount than in 2012. What increase are you talking about?
You're talking about a gap. I mean, I'm talking about raw numbers. And we can you can look that up, and everybody will look that up on the internet.
There are raw numbers because there are more black people who voted in 2016 than 2012
thing.
Because they were born. So, but you don't look at raw numbers. You look at percentages. The percentage did not increase.
Well, you look at the percentages, but I was saying that we have more.
You can't look at raw numbers, because if you have an increase in a number of people who are available to vote, that means you have more people. But if the percentage is the same, you don't have a bump.
Well, that's interesting you say you can't look at raw numbers, but, you know, people want to look at raw numbers when it comes to talk about Hillary Clinton getting the popular vote.
No, I deal with facts.
We can look at raw numbers.
I deal with facts. If I have 100 people voting over here in 1 year, and I have 200 people voting over here, and then you say, well, more people voted over here because it was 200 people voting. I can't look at the number. I look at what is the percentage. If the percentage of 100 people is 9%, the percentage of 200 people is 9%, you did not have an increase.
Well, Roland, people do that all the time. You know, you can look at numbers or percentages.
Not on this show.
In unemployment rates, people use unemployment rates and percentages instead of raw numbers. People are retiring in larger numbers
okay.
these year.
All right.
Is there wait.
Okay.
Is there a point in here?
Is
there a
point?
Is
this.
No, it's getting heated in here because it's supposed to.
Numbers or percentages.
There was not an increase among African Americans voting for Donald Trump. The percentages were flat. Now, if you think that's going to help Republicans, knock yourself out. But I'm saying the numbers were flat. That wasn't an increase.
Well, you're talking about now just one election. I went back to Romney, and I went back to election prior to that. African Americans
Romney
have
did worse
voted
than McCain.
African Americans have voted more and more Republican than Democrat. And people can go to the internet.
Kellyanne Conway must have walked in while turning the facts here.
We can all look it up.
You can look it up, but I know these by heart. Coming up next on News One Now, we'll talk with John Hope Bryan about his initiative to revamp the global economy with the help of the biggest influencers in just a moment. Again, a critically important summit here in Atlanta, the Hope Global Forum. Also, later in the show, we'll hear from Ambassador Andrew Young and John Rogers of Arrow Capital Management about what they think should be done when it comes to the invisible class. You know, all through the election, we heard about the white working class voter. You swear black folks were not part of the working class. All that next, right here, News One Now, broadcasting live from Atlanta. Back in a moment.
So you want the truth? Well, we got it.
That's how I talk. God knows it. I'm just straight.
It's News One Now with Roland Martin.
Well, folks, being here in Atlanta, obviously, folks know about the history of Morehouse College being 150 years college for black men. But there have been lots of drama at Morehouse over the last several months, some say several years. The Board of Trustees chose to get rid of their president, John Wilson, a graduate of Morehouse. And of course, when that decision was made, he was rather disappointed. All right, then. So we don't have a soundbite from John Wilson there. But as a result of lots of reporting being done, now we understand what was going on. Major friction between the then chair of the Morehouse board. Now, all of a sudden, we've seen a revamp over the weekend. The board of trustees decided to choose a new board of trustees. They also decided to appoint an interim president as well. They are saying that Morehouse is on the road to rebuilding itself and also repairing lots of damage that has taken place between the board of trustees, the president, as well as faculty and students. Some say that is not necessarily not the case. Let's talk to a student government association president right now, who's a member of the board of directors as well, who joins us here, Jonathan Hill. Jonathan, how you doing?
I'm well. Thank you for inviting me on the show this morning.
So this has been lots of drama. That was a big story that was done over the weekend on one of the black websites that just laid bare all the issues at Morehouse. A lot of people were stunned to see all of this backbiting and the friction. How important was it for the trustees to pick a new board chair and install that new board chair now?
Right. So, thank you for that question. I think it was very important for our entire board to come up with this decision. If you saw the reports, we said that we came up with a unanimous decision to one move forward as an institution and take this new step, which means that each and every board member in that room sort of kind of had to grab hope of what was left at Morehouse and sort of kind of push us forward. I think that, one, we have to continue to celebrate 150 years, but sort of kind of recognize where we are now in 150 years. Morehouse College right now has to redefine our identity, who we are in the 21st century, just like every HBCU. We're all struggling, and now it was an opportunity for Morehouse to sort of kind of restart and rebuild itself. And I think that's exactly what we did this weekend, and I'm very proud of such.
William Taggart, who was the chief operating officer, now interim president. It's going to be a national search for a new president. Then you have Willie Woods, who just joined the board last year,
correct,
who is now board chairman. As a student, but also a board member, what must this board do to interface with the students and the faculty, not just the alumni?
Of course. I think what this board has to do is like truly demonstrate what it means for Morehouse to exist right now in 2017. What that means is that we sort of kind of have to tangibly deliver to the students and faculty as far as like how do we plan to deliver and sort of kind of rebuild our relationships between the board, the students, and the faculty. Two, we have to find a better way to engage our alumni, our young alum as well as our older alum, the Spike Lees, the Jay Johnsons, and the Samuel Jacksons. Like, those are the individuals, like, who, don't get me wrong, have the name of Morehouse, but they aren't the only Morehouse men left.
And speaking of those individuals, they actually wrote a letter and signed it, calling the Board of Trustees to step up and lead.
Correct. And if you don't know, they actually reached out to me. I'm the reason that the letter actually got to the Board of Trustees. And as a student, when a Jay Johnson, Spike Lee, or Samuel Jackson reaches out to you, I mean, one, you stop in awe for a second and say, like, wow, these are some of my biggest heroes. But secondly, like, I appreciate the fact these are my Morehouse brothers, and their perspective on Morehouse is all love. That's the same thing that we have from the student body when we suit the chairman. It was all love. But at the end of the day, as an institution, we have to move forward. forward together. Chairman Willie Woods and President Bill Taggart, I think honestly, like, they do have a new look at Morehouse. This new leadership role right now, we sort of kind of have to just appreciate it for the moment. This is the first time a Howard man has ever led Morehouse College. That's one thing. Secondly, just to have a new chairman looking at the board, I think that Willie Woods does have a great look on the institution, whether it be our financial responsibility to Morehouse right now, or what's Morehouse's ability to sort of kind of grow and demonstrate exactly what we have to do for the outside world and the outside community. Because Morehouse College, at the end of the day, we are the beacon of black male excellence, and we sort of kind of have to demonstrate to the outside world exactly who we are and what we will continue to do for the next 150 years.
Derek, as you said, you have Willie Woods, chair of the board, didn't graduate from Morehouse, certainly, which has always been very insular in terms of leadership. But the reality is this here. Universities deal with these issues all the time.
Certainly.
Battles between board and the president. But also, the new chair made it perfectly clear that the next president of Morehouse may very well not be a Morehouse graduate, might not be a man. And so the university itself has to deal with this. It can't be insular. You don't have to have somebody who is a graduate of the school to lead the school. That's not the way it works in nearly all universities across the country.
You know, a lot of Morehouse men just fainted.
Well,
here's the thing. You know, the old gospel hymn said life is full of swift transition. As a Morris Brown alum, attended Clark Atlanta University, I've had this young man on my show. And one of the things that are very clear for all of us is that Morehouse is too important of an institution. I support it financially. I'm tremendously proud of these students who stood up and said something is wrong. They were actually denied access to a meeting. But now, Roland, I get kind of insular. Now it's time for us to come back to the house and sit our affairs in orders and put this institution back on the plane it needs to. And they got to realize that things change. And we are in a new reality now. Many of these institutions, HBCUs, kind of exist because of relationships that they've had all the way back with the White House. So it very well may be now it's time for someone different to lead this institution. College presidents have one fundamental responsibility, and that is raise money and keep the institution financially solvent. Mm-hmm. Who's ever best qualified to do that? That's who Morehouse need to go find.
Lynn, agree.
I think it's an exciting time. First of all, let me just say I love seeing leadership in your generation. You know, we say so much about what isn't happening with young people. This is terrific. Morehouse is going to survive. It will thrive. I love what you say about money because I think that's so important. So maybe a better business model.
Of course.
Better communication and get their bills and things all cleaned up, right?
Agreed. And engagement. Again, I think that now we're all talking about the traditions of Morehouse. And just like any HBCU, we love our traditions at our institution. But moving forward, maybe tradition isn't always best. Maybe it's time to break tradition. I think that I appreciate the opportunity, one, to serve on the search committee for the new president. But more than that, I appreciate the opportunity to be in those conversations where we now are saying, you know, maybe it's not going to be a Morehouse man. Maybe we need to think about a woman. The way that we're thinking now is the way that Morehouse College should have been thinking for the past couple of years.
Okay.
And I think that this time, this moment right now is a moment in history where Morehouse College is about to create its name again. We're going to continue to tell our story for the next 150 years.
All right, Jonathan Hill, we appreciate it. Thanks a bunch.
Thank you.
Folks, we did reach out to Morehouse to try to get their interim president on the show and board chair. We were unable to confirm them. And so my suggestion would be to leaders of Morehouse, you might want to come do the only black television show in America that focuses on black folks. Talk about Morehouse. I'm just saying, don't stay in hiding. Come talk to folks so they can get an understanding of what's happening with Morehouse. Up next, we'll talk with John Hope Bryant, who is the founder of Operation Hope, leader of this Hope Global Forums, give you an understanding of what it's about. Transforming the global economy, but also the economy for many of us, for African Americans and others, to move us ahead in these times. That's next, right here on News One Now TV One.
Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV One.
All right, folks, I'm here in Atlanta for the Hope Global Forum's annual summit, which is aimed at reimagining the global economy. Joining us right now is John Hope Bryant, the CEO and chairman of Operation Hope, and the person putting on this event. John, what's happening?
Well, 3,000 of my friends from around the world, 25 countries, even you, showed up here in Atlanta for this Hope Global Forum. We have billionaires next to multimillionaires, next to thousandaires, next to folks trying to buy some air and trying to borrow some air with their dreams. And this is what I call civil rights. Civil rights was waged and won in the streets. We all know that movement. And thank God that Ambassador Young and Reverend C.T. Vivian, who are here, hung their lives on the line to make sure we had lives that we could thrive with. But that future is not guaranteed. We got to quote Bernice King, who's here last night, Dr. Bernice King, CEO of the King Center, we got to fight for our democracy every day, reclaim it every day, right? And so this new movement's in the suites, not the streets. It's about class and poverty, not race and the color line. Whether you're white, black, red, brown, or yellow, you want to see some more green. And whatever city you're living in America today, Roland, you're struggling. If you're living in New York City and you're making $70,000 a year, which sounds like a lot of money, you're struggling to make ends meet. I don't care what color you are. You're living in here in Atlanta making $50,000 a year, yes, middle class. You're struggling to make ends meet. You got too much month at the end of your money. We have a hope inside at the Atlanta Police Department here, and the police chief will be here, $48,000 with a badge and a gun.
So
these
what?
Are, these are people, right? And they're stressed.
So in terms of what will take place, because we started last night, conversation with John Rogers Jr., Ambassador Andrew Young, we'll have that in just a moment. Yeah. What do you want to see come out of this? What has happened in the past based upon the discussions, the conversations, the folks who have met here?
Relationships. Nothing in life happens without relationships. I have a book dropping today from my publisher, Barry Kohler, called The Memo. And basically it comes out in September. And my point is we never got the memo on money and free enterprise. That goes back to the Freedmen's Bank of 1865, Abraham Lincoln and Frederick Douglass. Frederick Douglass, who you know to be a businessman who put $10,000 of his own money.
Who's not still here, Trump. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
That's right.
Go ahead.
He passed some time ago. But his legacy's alive.
Right.
So we give him credit for that.
Yes.
And this is a businessman who was an abolitionist, not an abolitionist who did other things.
Exactly.
He owned real estate in Baltimore, owned lots of real estate in Anacostia, put $10,000 of his own money, I'm getting to your question, in this government bank, which he knew he wasn't going to get back, in 1865, after Lincoln was assassinated, and it was said the failure of this bank did more to set freed slaves in America back than 10 more years of slavery. It's not like we got the memo and screwed it up, Roland. We never got the memo. So this meeting is about building those relationships with capital. It's about creating a new color, green. It's about going from just being a PhD to a PhD. And then it's about cutting deals. It's about getting people to start, the young lady who gave me this bracelet last night, 17-year-old, started a business. She was selling her stuff here. She was pitching on stage in front of Henry Ford III, in front of the largest mutual fund black-owned in the country, who invested money in her business. This young lady also, she made me buy hers, was selling.
Good for her.
Good for her.
Right thing to do.
So it's really about operationalizing a whole generation of builders. I don't care what you're building. Build a daycare network, okay? Build churches that are ethical and honest and that give more than you get. No Rolls Royce running preachers. Build a series of barbershops. I don't care what you build, but build a network. Build content. Build yourself. Build in a university. You know, talking about Morehouse and what you're absolutely right about, what it takes to lead a university these days. We need a software upgrade in the black community. Now, I know you're talking to everybody. But specifically, I love my black folks. We desperately need a software upgrade. We cannot keep doing what we've been doing 60 years ago, marching and screaming and hollering and expect that's gonna be relevant in the 21st century.
Derek, question.
I think you're right on it. I mean, the reality of it is when you look at a progressive city like Atlanta, with nearly 50 years of continual black leadership, the wealth gap here is so significant that we got to begin to say, how do we undo this? A child born in poverty at Grady Hospital today is almost not likely to be able to climb from that. We've got to ask, why is that
right.
So? And I think John Hope Bryant does that better than most here.
John?
Well, we're raising credit scores 120 points in 24 months. Luckily, when you're running a conference, you get them to shut things down. We're going to get them to shut down that noise in the back.
Well, it's all good. First of all, for everybody who's at home watching, the first session begins at 8 a.m. once we go off the air. So I'm not worried about it. They're doing their job. We're doing ours, so go ahead.
Yeah, but it's nice to still be able to tell them to shut it down. that's CEO. So we're raising credit scores 120 points in 24 months because nothing changes your life more than God or love than moving your credit score 120 points. So these neighborhoods that we're concerned about, on the west side of Atlanta, but also Detroit, wherever you happen to be watching right now, you have a check cashier next to a payday loan lender, next to a rent-to-own store, next to a title lender, next to a liquor store, robbing us in broad daylight. That's not racism. That's target marketing. They are targeting you. You are these are predators seeing you as a financially illiterate, right, low self-esteem victim. And I'm tired of being a victim, so Hope Inside sets you free. And we're mobilizing 1,000 of those locations to finish the work of the Freedmen's Bank. That's the Innovator of the Year Award from the American Banker, and that's getting operationalized at this annual meeting.
All right, hold tight 1 second. I got to go to a break real quick. When we come back, we're going to hear from Ambassador Andrew Young and as well as John Rogers, and we're going to continue our conversation. We're supposed to have Chris Gardner, but he is under the weather, not a problem. John, he can keep talking, so it's no sweat. We're back, News One Now, broadcasting live here from Atlanta, Hope Global Forum. Trust me, a conversation that is important, which is why we are here and chose to broadcast from this summit. Back, News One Now, TV One, in just a moment.
The first step is to join the movement.
Begin to mobilize and move people to action now.
Step number two, roll out.
The way I roll is, when you've shown one time you can do it, no excuses after that.
We're your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with Roland Martin. Roland Martin.
Last night, folks, Hope Global Forums kicked off with a great night. Speech by Chris Gardner, also pitches by some young entrepreneurs, but also there was a conversation I moderated with John Rogers Jr. of Arrow Capital Management, as well as Ambassador Andrew Young. Take a listen.
I talked to Reverend Jackson today, and you know, Reverend Jackson's often always talking about the fact that we need access to capital, which is true, but we also need access to customers. And I think that's one of the things that we know from the legacy from Ambassador Young and from Maynard Jackson. They made sure that the city was there as a great customer for minority businesses. And then they used the bully pulpit to pressure the anchor institutions, the universities, the hospitals, the museums, the major corporations to do business with our community. We're not pushing that battle anymore. We're not fighting that battle anymore. We're letting these anchor institutions only work with other white institutions, and then we don't have access to customers. If you look at the Black Enterprise list now of top 100 companies, there's a disproportionate amount of African-American businesses that are in the food service industry. And that's because McDonald's, for example, where I've been on the board the last 14 years, works with minority suppliers consistently, and it's had a long history of minority franchisees. And those are the businesses that have been able to grow and thrive. We need to have our anchor institutions, again, working with our local businesses, and then we'll be able to hire and employ our own community.
Let me just say, I mean, I'm not arguing with any of this. I am saying it's irrelevant.
Why?
Race is irrelevant right now. And if you want to think racially, that was 1960. Amazon is closing Sears. That ain't got nothing to do with race. I mean, you buy on Amazon instead of the Sears Roebuck catalog.
John, when we still look at what's happening in this country, you have this divide, this view that, as you said earlier, that things have just gotten so much greater for African Americans compared to others. In your experience, how then do we get Black, white, Latino, Asian, Native American to understand that if you are invisible and I'm invisible, both of us invisible, and somebody else is totally ignoring us, it makes sense for us to get together to become visible?
Well, one of the things I would add to, you know, one of the things in your prior life, you know, you ran the Chicago Defender, you know, which is our iconic newspaper that has really gotten to be quite tiny in Chicago. And I think
I tried to tell them, let me stay there.
Well, go ahead, I'm sorry.
And, yeah, you've worked out great with your career. But what I bring that up because I think that we have to have strong political leadership that we've learned here in Atlanta. We also have to have a strong Black media and that can get out and tell our stories and tell the world how we're not getting the opportunities that we really deserve.
If you're going to be in business in today's world, tomorrow's world, of the 9 billion people on the planet, 4 billion of them are going to be African. And the economy in Europe is declining. The economy in China is leveled off. It's India and Africa, and the United States of America. And that's why I think, that's also why I think that the Googles and the Apples are looking for the new markets.
But to your question, I do think that the pressure matters. I think we have to support our civil rights organizations and our civil rights leaders, because what Reverend Jackson's been able to do, and Reverend Sharpton and others, has really moved the needle. I mean, I've seen it close up there in Silicon Valley, and I've also seen it in Wall Street, because Reverend Jackson has his Wall Street project and is starting to push those private equity firms and the hedge funds and the investment banks and the larger banks to have more diversity in their institutions for the first time. And it's so important, because if you think about it, the wealth really in today's society is being grown in two places. The lot of billionaires in Silicon Valley, but there's an awful lot on Wall Street.
See, if we're talking about getting this nation or getting our states and cities to see the invisible class, what do you charge the folks in this room to do when they leave this forum?
I charge you to do what my daddy told me to do. And that is, he said, son, this Ivory soap, 99.44, 100% pure. That ain't good enough for you. Ivory soap is white, you black. And you got to know that. You have to have a different vision. You have to have a different morality. You have to, if you see things like everybody else and want to be like everybody else, that ain't no, that's not progress. They even told me about Toynbee that the reason black folk may save Western civilization is the fact that they're the only thing different than the cultures of Western Europe coming here.
And Ambassador Young, has been great to come to our conference we have every year for African Americans on corporate boards. It's called the Black Corporate Directors Conference, and Deloitte and Russell Reynolds are our partners in that. And what we try to do every year is bring African Americans that are on Fortune 500 companies together to learn how to be leaders in the boardroom. But in particular, we're trying to learn and remind all of our board members the importance of taking a civil rights agenda into the boardroom every single time they step into those boardrooms when they're fortunate to be on a corporate board. So every year we'll have what we call the conscience of the conference. Someone like Ambassador Young, we had Eric Holder, we've had Reverend Jackson, we've had Harry Belafonte, we even had by a video the late Maynard Jackson, to remind those of us that are on these boards that we have a responsibility to fight for our community when we're there and not sit idly by and not fight for us. And I think that's really what we have to do. It's us. It's up to us to make a difference. Whether we're in the corporation or we're at a university or we're in the boardroom, we've got to sort of live the values of fighting for us every day and making sure that we're included in everything that those institutions are all about.
Ambassador.
I think we have to take the leadership. And if, well, Delta wasn't flying to Africa till I got on the board. And I had to almost blackmail them into doing that. Now they're two most prosperous flights, the most money-making flights to Nigeria and to South Africa. And I mean, McKinsey sued the city to try to keep us from building an international terminal. I mean, Delta paid for it because they wanted to be a regional airline with a few national routes. We said, the hell you say, not in Atlanta. This is the next great international city. And folks said, where in the hell did that crazy nigga come from? I mean, that's exactly what they said. And I said, that crazy nigga has been around the world and knows what's going on. It ain't my fault that I got to the UN. That was Jimmy Carter's fault. I didn't want to go there. But I'm saying, once you go and see where the money is, and once you go and see where the future is, you can't be just like everybody else. You got to come back and be fighting and fussing and nice. So I think you got to cuss people out and tell them to go to hell and make them look forward to the trip.
Yeah. Final comment I'll leave is this here. I made the point earlier when I made it clear to my staff and our network, we're going to be broadcasting from here, and that is you can be two things. You can be present or you can have presence. And I think for a lot of us, we're present in various companies, but we have no presence.
Very good.
So as John said, how are we using our voices? I did the Monique show a few years ago. She said, man, you on CNN, and I love watching you, but I'm afraid the stuff you say, you're going to get fired. I said, well, Monique, I start every job with the premise I'm going to get fired anyway. But there's nothing worse than being in a place, having present, being present, and they still fire you anyway, and then you go home mad as hell, you never said anything. Whereas you'd be like me, if you get fired, cool, I said every damn thing while I was there. That's called having presence.
But if you get fired for a reason, you got somebody else to pick you up that wants to hear what you got to say.
And that's why I have five revenue streams, so if I get fired one place, I got four others. Folks.
Now that doesn't mean five wives.
No, one wife.
This is Christianity.
John Rogers, Ambassador Andrew Young. All right, folks, back from the Hope Global Forum in 60 seconds right here, News One Now on TV One.
Your centerpiece for black thoughts in America.
I don't bend, I don't break.
It's News One Now with Roland Martin.
Welcome back, folks, to Atlanta, the Hope Global Forum. Joining us, of course, John Hope Bryant, Chairman and CEO, Operation Hope. We got putting this whole thing on. Also, Lynn May, journalist and communications consultant. Also joining us, Derek Bozeman, WAOK Radio Weekday host. Darrell Wilson, CEO of Wilson Mediation. John, who are some of the folks you're going to have speaking today and the rest of the week?
We have Hank Aaron, the baseball great, but also business leader. People don't know that he's a business leader, a philanthropist. His wife, Billy, will be here, who has done more for black kids and colleges than most anybody I know as a couple. He owns BMW dealerships and businesses and creates jobs, but we know him as a baseball great. He's going to show his story today with Ambassador Andrew Young. Henry Ford III will be here, the police chief, the Atlanta school chief, the mayor. We've got billionaires from New York and leaders from around the world. And we are going to be disruptive, Roland. I don't mean that in any kind of negative way.
Right.
But we need, our community needs disruption. We have to disrupt the poverty. We need to disrupt the depression. I think that 70% of us are clinically undiagnosed depressed. We need to disrupt the hopelessness. And I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired, so I just told my co-host that I'm willing to not be liked. That's my new mission. It's okay if you don't like me. I like me. I'd rather you respect me and not like me.
Lynn.
Like me and never respect me.
You know, I think that's a good attitude because you can't get anything done unless you're willing to take some risks and speak truth to people who need to hear it.
Yeah.
You know? Yep. I like disruption. That means we have to change things. We can't accept things as they always been. That's what's happening in politics today. That's what needs to happen in the black community. We need more entrepreneurs. This is a great program.
Well, the key, John, as I would say, is not just need more entrepreneurs, also building capacity.
Yes.
You know, we went from 1.9 million black-owned businesses to 2.6 million, but the average revenue of those businesses dropped by nearly 30,000. Of the 2.6 million, 2.5 million only have one employee. It's also building capacity.
Yes.
And growing.
Yeah, it's what we don't know that's killing us. But we think we know. And we think just because we got wearing a suit and driving a leased car and have a nice wardrobe, that's middle class. That's not middle class, right? That's the teetering class. Folks are too much month at the end of their money, so we need to build financial literacy capacity. That's the new civil rights issue. What did Andrew Young say? To live in a system of free enterprise and not to understand the rules of free enterprise must be the definition of slavery. What you're doing, you're building a network, right? You're partnering with this great company, but you're also building your own content factory. You need to teach people about this game so folks don't think about walking around with a TV camera, somebody means you're a broadcaster. Quincy Jones told me, if you don't own publishing rights, music rights,
yeah,
or licensing rights, and you think you're in the music business, you're actually not in the music business, you're a temporary performer.
Exactly, and Beyonce knows this, and she has built an empire based exactly on that model.
Quincy Jones is worth $500 million, ownership. I hate to say it this way, but when Michael Jackson died, he was making money on Michael Jackson's estate. Sorry you died, Michael, but he's still getting paid because he owns part of the... So we need capacity all around. That's why I think the Freedman's Bank story is such an incredible story that is untapped because we never got the memo on money.
And we didn't get the memo on our history, knowing that history.
Derek, final comment real quick.
The battle is for the hearts and minds of our people, and now is about a love imperative. Do we love our people enough to go hard for them? And that's what this conference is about. That's what we got to be about, period, point blank.
Darrell, final comment.
It's a great program. You know, I'm all about free enterprise, and hopefully that also includes learning more about government and how government gets out of the way of free enterprise.
Lynn, final comment?
Absolutely. This is exciting. I think it's a beginning, and I think if we don't have hope now, when will we?
John, 30 seconds.
I'm with Roland Martin. I'm going to carry his bags wherever I go. He got me on Facebook Live. I got 26 million followers because this man told me to shut up and listen because God gave you 2 ears and 1 mouth so you listen twice as much as you talk. So I'm going to shut up right now.
All right, folks, again, we're here at the Hope Global Forum. You can go to their Facebook page. You can actually, they're going to be live streaming many of these events as well. And so, and then as soon as it's over, I'm going to go set my encoder up and live stream this as well to my Periscope, YouTube, and Facebook pages as well, because it's information that you know you need to hear. And as Kathy Hughes, the founder of Radio One, said, information is power. John, thanks a bunch, man.
Thank you, brother.
We appreciate it.
Honored you being here.
Thanks a bunch, folks. Back, 60 seconds, News One Now, TV One.
The first step is to join the movement.
Begin to mobilize and move people to action now.
Step number two, roll out.
The way I roll is, when you've shown one time you can do it, no excuses after that.
We're your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with Roland Martin. Roland Martin.
Birthday shout-out time. Rapper and activist David Banner turns 43. On this day in history, in 1881, Spelman College is founded right here in Atlanta. In 1966, Emmitt Ashford becomes the first black umpire in Major League Baseball during a game between the Cleveland Indians and the Washington Senators. In 1979, Uganda dictator Idi Amin is deposed. All right, folks, tomorrow on News One Now, more from the Hope Global Forums. Of course, we'll bring you a lot of the great speakers here. So look forward on our social media accounts. You can hit me on Twitter at Roland S. Martin. Also, you can friend the show on News One's Facebook page or mine as well. And so, again, we want you guys to stay informed as we try to keep you empowered. And you know how I feel. Broke is broke. Get paid. We got to go. How?
Your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America.
I don't bend, I don't break.
It's News One Now with Roland Martin.